This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark AmTower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. AmTower Off-Center with your host, Mark AmTower.
Welcome to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower because nobody else volunteered. My guest today is Martha Johnson. Martha, you may remember, was the administrator at GSA and the author of On My Watch, Leadership Innovation and Personal Resilience. Martha, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's delightful to be here.
Thank you for coming in. You did volunteer to be you, right?
So, I did.
Yeah. And frankly, I think you did a pretty darn good job at it.
Well, thank you.
Let's do a little career background here, because I don't think a lot of people understand that you have a background that includes both private sector, contractor, and government service well before whatever fan that was came along.
Well, you know, I always love to talk about myself and my career. The overarching notion about my career was I wanted to have a lot of different experiences. So about two-thirds of my career was in the private sector. And in some ways, I was prepping for the GSA job for a long time because I started in the transportation industry, in the automotive
GSA
business.
Runs the biggest fleet.
Yeah, and they do run the biggest fleet. And then I moved to an architecture firm where I was the CFO. And then I worked as a consultant, so I learned how to do the consulting contracting thing. I've also worked in IT organizations, so I got the information technology bit. I was in the Clinton administration from January 20th to January 20th, the whole 8 years. A chunk of it, 5 years of it, I was at GSA as the chief of staff. And so when I had the opportunity to return to GSA as the administrator, I was able to remember what all the acronyms were and who the people were. And it was just terrific because I was returning to something I knew really well. But you're right. I've been a contractor and I've been in the private sector. And some people say I can't hold a job, but I think it was about developing all kinds of experiences so I could write books.
Well, there you go. And is this the first one?
That is not my first book. I've had a couple of other books. The most important book before this to me was a novel that I wrote right after I came out of office in 2012. I had been working on a novel. I've been writing it on the bus, actually. I live in Annapolis. It's a nice bus ride, and it's cheap. And the novel
has done... And you don't have to drive.
I don't have to drive. And so I would do some email, and then I'd say, no, I want to write my novel. I finished that after I came out of office, and it was a wonderful thing to do. It kind of rebooted me in a lot of ways, and I think everyone needs a really creative thing that they do, whether it's cooking or ice skating or whatever, so that they can say back to the world, I'm still here, and I do produce and generate, and I have a lot to offer. And the novel has done quite well, actually, and not in terms of sales. That's not how you calculate books these days. It's in terms of recognition, and I think it's, and I'm giving talks about it. It's particularly aligned with the LGBT community, and so I speak to PFLAG organizations and so on about it.
Okay. I very much believe that, you know, I would love to have a bestseller.
Wouldn't we all?
One of my books was an Amazon bestseller, top 10 in and out for a little while. But I much prefer to have people come to me several years later and said, you know, I just reread this and, you know, that's cool. There's
that's
nothing
wonderful.
Feeling like
yes,
that.
Yes, so. Yes. Or to have people say, I cried when I read your book. I was touched.
Yes. I believe everybody has a book in them and everybody has a country song in them. The question is whether when it comes out, you should share it with anybody.
Good point. I'll have to think about that country song thing.
Frankly, you've got a great country song, and maybe we can sit down and work on a parody. Doesn't have to be straight up country, but I want to talk about some of the things that led up, not led up to, that you did prior to being asked to vacate the premises. there's some programs that you were involved in at GSA that made me a huge fan while you were going on. You and I date back. Your first GSA time in the 90s was during the CASU program.
Right.
And there was the beginnings of the collaborative efforts then, the shared expense things with the cooperative admin support program, and telework. And these things have played a huge role in your tenure.
Yes, the whole flexible workplace, the workplace of the future is a huge change for the government, and it's one that we wanted to promote and exemplify and shake the feathers on. We really wanted to help the government understand that it needed to change how it works in order to become more productive and to be more flexible and agile in this modern world. And one of the ways to do it is actually to change how you work, and how you work and where you work and what kind of technology you use are big interruptions. So it was a wonderful time when there had been a lot of paving of the road, so that we were getting close to it being a flexible workplace being a more normal, welcomed idea. Mm-hmm. I think these things have to germinate for a while in big bureaucracies.
But sometimes a long
time. But GSA was, GSA is in the middle of the whole government. Judiciary, executive branch, legislative branch, country, county, local. We touch all of those. And so if we can nudge something forward, it can have a huge reach strategically if you think about the positioning. So our effort to become a more flexible workplace and to promote that, we thought had far-reaching consequences that were great. And, the whole idea of a flexible workplace is, first of all, it allows you to have a lot more flexibility around commuting, and Washington is a very choked-up town.
Ran through that this morning.
there are financial incentives. It's incentivizing to recruit talent against. It's also a much better use of space. We have huge rent bills across the organization, but that's not the only reason. It's really because we are collaborating, and who is sitting in there at their desk all the time? And managers no longer have the job of watching their workers. That might have been true when everybody spoke different languages and were immigrants in industrial settings 150 years ago. It's not true anymore.
No, it's not. The other thing that you were involved in, I've been watching the LEAD type activities for a while. And you were, again, pushing this heavily, but your big project was redoing 1800.
Yes, we redid our headquarters to encourage everyone to understand what the flexible workplace was about, and also to dramatically change energy consumption. And that was the big push, the sort of overarching push, was to push for a zero footprint, a zero environmental footprint, which is important because for two reasons. One is reducing our energy footprint is all about reducing waste. And if everybody keeps telling the government to reduce waste and just cut budgets, they might want to get a little more creative and find other ways to encourage people to reduce waste. And one of them is to attach everyone to the notions of the environment and what we need to do to be good stewards of the environment. So there's a no waste component to the environmental effort. There's also an innovation component. If you're really going to change how we are consuming, we need to innovate, not just tighten our belts. And both those innovation and no waste notions are very important for the federal government. So the environmental effort was a big deal, and it acted out in the real estate world with how we built and managed and designed our buildings.
And you were a CFO at a real estate
firm? I was a CFO at a real estate, at an architecture firm in Boston.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so when you take over as head of GSA, you have federal acquisition, you got the fleet, and you have this little thing called PBS. manages just a couple of, rental properties or something?
A few leased,
yeah.
Too. and I mean, it's a massive opportunity to help the government rework its ideas about where and how it can become more effective and efficient. Innovative and efficient.
It goes back to, not to belabor this particular point, one of the issues of CASU was cost avoidance.
Yes. And I, you know, we all want to talk about costs and taxpayer dollars and budgets, and those are critical. It's not the only reason, though. It's about being effective so that the dollars you spend are ratcheted up that much more.
Yeah.
But the building that we redid, we were finally given in the Recovery Act, we were given some budget to redo our building. We had not done it. We reworked all the other major buildings in Washington over the years. It had not been touched since it was built in 1917. And it was a time to upgrade it. And we took the advantage of the opportunity to make a big statement about how we could do it more creatively.
Actually, I think Frank McDonough, when I used to visit him, had an office from about 18, or a desk from about 1800. It was cool, and it was huge.
We had been in that building a long time. Wires all over the place.
There you go. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Back with Martha after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest today is Martha Johnson. I would strongly suggest you pick up her book, On My Watch. It is available everywhere. It has been an Amazon bestseller, probably for a while.
On and off.
Mine flitted in and out.
That rating system is a little bit of a wonder.
It can be gamed too.
Of course.
Not game it. I doubt if you gamed it.
I did not game it.
Anyway, let's talk about the process of writing. You indicated that number one, this is not your first book. You have a novel.
Mm-hmm.
You also wrote.
I wrote a book back in the 90s when I was particularly working with the youth group at my church, wrote a book about the youth Sundays that they were designing and writing and leading, taking 6th graders through 12th graders as a little mob and orchestrating them so that they were able to lead a worship service. It was just a huge, wonderful, fun thing to do. And I returned to some of that recently, but at that time we had done maybe 9 different services, and so we published them, and they were very well received. Of course, you have a captive audience in the Presbyterian Church, but
well, there you go.
But that was really fun. and then I did my novel, and I've always thought about books. I've got another book coming along, just about to sign a contract to do that. So it's
fiction,
all good.
Nonfiction.
This one's nonfiction, although I still have a sequel to my novel in my head that I'd like to do. I just have to find a bus to ride
and
get it written.
Well, you know, I know you're going to New York, so
yes, I could take the train and start doing that. Yeah.
Trains. I read a lot on the train. I haven't written a lot on the train. So, but let's get up to this book. When word came out that you were writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
Some were hopeful that you were going to use your foot in possibly untoward ways to people, and it just didn't come out that way.
No, I decided I never wanted to write a kiss-and-tell book. I mean, be real. A kiss-and-tell book about GSA. It's going to be a real bestseller for years. I'm not the Secretary of State, you know. GSA, people think of it as Girl Scouts of America. It would not have much of an audience, and it would not have much of an audience beyond Washington. So that was never on the list. And I did not really, it just wasn't the book I wanted to write. What I wanted to write was about my 30-plus years in organizations, and I'm one of those people who, like everybody else, thinks I have a whole lot of real important, valuable experience and wisdom to share. But my approach to it is I really didn't want to tell people what they should be doing. I didn't want to explain to people how to do a supply chain or how to, you know, do this or that, because it's not about telling people how to do things. It's about explaining what goes on in organizations. And I've been lucky to be in the middle and on the top of massive organizations, contracting organizations, industrial organizations, professional services organizations. And it's really about what is going on in this organization so that you can kind of understand your context better, then you can make better decisions. And that seems to play really well with young people trying to figure out their careers. Why do people act this way? What is the protocol? How does this work? Why are we doing it this way? And I'm really pleased because the book is being picked up by colleges and universities. It's being used in curriculum at Old Dominion and NYU and
LBJ. I hope it's being picked up by the schools that teach public administration.
Yes, the LBJ school is one of them, yeah. Okay. And I'm really pleased. Government professors are picking it up too. So it is about that context, not about sanctimonious answers.
Okay. Why'd you call it On My Watch?
Oh, well, On My Watch, I live in Navy Town. So there is a little bit of a sense that I live in Annapolis, and there's a little bit of a sense of, you know, there's the academy and that sense of duty about being on the watch, being at the helm. And it does center around my story of being at GSA and then resigning from GSA in the face of a scandal. So it is a little bit about saying, you know, I took serious leadership is something I took seriously, and I have a lot of sense of responsibility about, and it had that sort of stand up and do what needs to be done kind of feel to it. Mm-hmm. It's also meant to be about sensible leadership. On My Watch is about, here I am, I'm responsible, but it's not a big glorified thing. This is my responsibility. This is what we have to be sensible about. So how do you do that? How do you frame those issues and get on with it?
Okay. I'm not familiar with your publisher.
Dudley Court Press. It's a small publisher. She's somebody I went to school with, actually. She found me. And she was as much of a writing coach as she was a publisher because she knows me so well.
Okay.
And I have to say, it's a smallish book. You can get through it in an evening. It could have been about 900 pages. And that's the real value of a good publisher. They say, no, I don't think it's quite that. Take it out.
Well,
take all that out.
You know what? People aren't going to read 900 pages anyway.
Not.
It goes up on the book, you know.
No.
Everybody in D.C. has Woodward's books on their shelves, and nobody's read them except for Bob and three or four people, and that's it. You know.
Well, this is short and readable. Since I've been a novelist, I want the words on the page to be ones that grab you. Maya Angelou, you know, just one of the quotes about her is that she says she wanted people to read her novels and by page 40 to suddenly realize they were reading a novel, that they were reading, but that they were so captured by it, they weren't even clear that they were reading it. They were just
part
absorbing it,
yeah. It.
And that's kind of, I take the actual language and the stories and the metaphors and all that very seriously. I've taught English. That's one of the jobs I did when I was like, young person.
I did too. I have a master's degree in American literature.
Oh, there you go. Well, then you can appreciate it so much.
I still want to write the great American novel, but I'm apparently better at writing marketing stuff.
Well, the great American novel is a question. Writing a novel is the first hurdle.
Right. And we can debate that. How do you write? Do you have a time of day that you find more productive?
Well, I learned when I did that bus thing that I am really good in the morning, and it's mostly about getting in front of the computer and typing. Now, I also am one of those people who was taught to type 90 words a minute, so I can type faster than I can think. And it's wonderful because you just splat a whole lot of stuff out and get it going. Then you can go back and edit it. And I am always surprised when people can't use all 10 fingers to type. But that's a whole other discussion.
Now that's
I was trained
me.
To be a secretary, you see. So I write in the morning, and I since I am out of big organizational life, I then try to swim in the afternoon. I taught myself to swim after I left office, and so now I swim in the afternoon. And
you didn't know how to swim before?
I didn't. I could kind of float, but that was about it.
Cool.
And so I learned that and watched videos and taught myself, and then
Tai Chi. Right. Go to Tai Chi.
Yes, and then that wakes me up, and I can then write again. But I have to say, for the most part, I write in the morning and I edit in the afternoon. It's just the words just come out in the morning.
Okay. I type with two fingers, so I got Dragon Naturally Speaking, and I speak my books.
Some people talk them into tape recorders. I'm amazed at that. I'm not that
the
organized.
Tape recorder doesn't transcribe. Dragon transcribes.
The Dragon transcribes, right.
So, and frankly, I find that I have much better editable material if I speak it first.
Interesting.
So it's much more conversational, and I've been told that that it's very easy to read. So.
Well, it's more conversational than it must be.
Yeah.
Because the management books and leadership books are not actually the books I like to read. And here I am writing one. Yeah, so I wanted to cut a different contract with my reader.
This is not the only writing you do.
No.
Tell me a little bit about the blog.
Oh, I blog.
You don't share all the titles, please.
I won't.
we aren't run by Mormons anymore, but.
Yes. No, they're not that salacious. But I've been blogging for about half a year now, and I try to blog four or five times a week. I don't do op-eds. They aren't deeply researched. What they are is they're meant to be a small idea that I put out in a couple of paragraphs that you can catch when you're drinking your coffee or something easy. And they're little interruptions in how you think about this or that. They're about reframing ideas that you just hold as habit. And I like this notion that we need to change because we get used to changing, and we're just doing a little bit of it all the time. And the blog is about that. And it's about organizational life and careers and workplace and change and leadership and that world of material. But it's about how we conduct ourselves, and I want to interrupt people's thinking and give them little new ideas.
Okay, very cool. Before we go on, I want to clarify something. You were in the private sector. I want people to understand that you were not in the private sector in some twinky little startup or this or that. You did serious time at both SRA and CSC.
I did, so, and at Cummins Engine Company.
And Cummins, right.
Yeah, okay. Big manufacturing, yes. Big in IT, big companies. CSC is 90,000 people, you know, a lot of big organizations. And the startling thing about all of those was that I happened to have been there as they were going through absolutely huge radical change, massive change. CSC was globalizing like nobody's business. Cummins was facing down the competition that was coming from Japan. This was in the 80s. And we had to completely redo how we built engines. And we had to do it in 26 months. I tell this story so many times, my friends are sick of it, but it's true. So I learned early on about how you can take big structures and twist them around to change and get people going.
I was at an award ceremony for Howard Tech Council last night, and I don't know when the show's going to air, but it doesn't matter because nobody will know about that. But the keynote was the head of manufacturing for General Electric.
Oh, interesting.
And this woman told some fantastic stories about how they are now doing things. So,
It's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. And it was a revolution, a true revolution in industry, which I am certainly hoping the government could absorb.
One would hope. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio. Back with Martha after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest today is Martha Johnson. Pick up the book, On My Watch, Leadership, Innovation, and Personal Resilience. It'll be well worth your time. It is, as she said, a relatively short read, but don't take it lightly because it's short. It's a powerful book. Let's talk about the conditions that led up to the resignation. GSA is huge.
GSA is large. It is very large.
And just, you know, you have your own like little diaspora there. I mean, it's far flung.
It is.
Mm-hmm. How can you know everything that's going on in an organization that size?
Well, you can't. And first chapter of my book is Leading in the Dark. There is a hubris among leaders to think that they can know everything that's going on in an organization. They can't. And they shouldn't, actually, because that undercuts their leadership teams, who also have responsibilities. But if you're trying to know everything they know, then what are they there for? So it's a complicated battle between trusting people and establishing enough of an openness and transparent norm that people will feel they can bring you the troubles and the problems. And then size enters in. And of course, GSA is so large. And when you think about 13,000 people and tens of thousands of contractors and, you know, billions of dollars of budget and program and so forth, one person can't know it. It's almost ironic in this age of information. We have so much more information and you feel as if you're supposed to know everything. Mm-hmm. You really do. You work hard. You get briefed. You read all night, all your papers, but you can't. And it's hubris to think you can. So you have to figure out how you function.
The thing that blows me away, there's two things that blow me away. This was about $800,000. $800,000 caused one of the biggest ripple effect things throughout government, destroying the ability, from my perspective as an advisor to contractors, of feds to meet industry in semi-neutral situations, conferences, meetings, etc. I mean, the far-flung nature of this from a couple of morons overspending and gloating about it, but it was $800,000. That's nothing.
Well, it's nothing in grand government budgets, but it's a number that's closer to what an individual can recognize. You know, it's still way beyond that. Yeah. But if you're talking about $80,000, you're talking about something that people really understand. Mm-hmm. And so 800 isn't as far away. 8 million is even harder for people to really grasp.
Right.
Because it just doesn't calculate to rent and car payments and so on. So I think it's a recognizable number, but it was certainly, relatively speaking, not a big number. Obviously, symbolically speaking, it became a huge number.
Well, it led to one of my favorite incidents, the muffin incident, when somebody at one of the publications found something in a GAO report that indicated that $15 was spent on a muffin at a breakfast meeting. Oh, it didn't turn out to be a muffin. It turned out to be continental breakfast. And at any meeting, $15 for a continental breakfast is about the norm. And at spiffy hotels, and this was at a relatively nice hotel, that's cheap. So when that part came out, it did not make the press. The only part that came out was the $15 muffin. Washington Post.
I think the symbolic nature of this is what was obviously so powerful. Yeah. There were
stupid videos didn't help.
Oh yeah, I think we're still learning as a society the fact that Big Brother is watching, and sometimes we turn it on ourselves, and so all of this is recorded, and then how and what to do with that is we're all getting used to those norms. We aren't used to them yet.
Yeah, and you did have a little more warning than when it hit the press. Yeah. But not a tremendous amount.
Well, they had been investigating for quite a long time, and we had been waiting. Probably the thing that is painful for me, well, the thing that is particularly difficult is that when you ask an IG to do a report, you don't presuppose what that report is, even if it gives you ideas about it, because you wait for the report to be issued.
Right.
And so some of the tension around it was, why didn't you act faster? Well, I was following due process, the kind of due process we all want to respect. And yet our ideas about immediate reaction and dismay and thrashing in the wake of learning about something is also the other side of American politics. So we were banging between the due process expectations and the other side.
Yeah. So all of this stuff hits the fan. The press, in its glee, overreacts, feeding Capitol Hill with, you know, more 15-second seekers, like they need more fodder. But, you know, the culmination comes, all this pressure comes on to the White House, and, you know, somebody's got to fall on the sword.
You know, I really don't know what actually unfolded. All I know was that I had lost the support of the White House. And when that became evident to me, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure that out. The option you have is to fall on the sword. And I think that's the buildup to it and what was going on behind the scenes. There's so many things that were playing. I mean, it was a political year. It was the beginning of a presidential campaign year. And the president was running against a management candidate. And this was the management organization for the government. And, you know, some people say, well, you know, they treated you because you were a woman. They treated you harder. And, you know, there's that critique. And then there's the critique of, GSA You watch Downton Abbey, right? GSA is the downstairs staff. And everybody expects it to be perfect, and when it isn't, they can throw a tantrum. And GSA is a hardworking bunch of people doing an extraordinarily big job, but it's not well understood. It is just not well understood. People want to talk about programs and policy. They are not necessarily going to take a lot of time to fill their minds with the complexities of how you run a government and manage a government. So I think we were caught in a bit of a perfect storm of a number of different things.
Yeah. And you know, you get to the nitty-gritty. One of my favorite programs run by GSA is the credit card, or charge card program.
Charge card.
David Shea has done a magnificent job there for a number of years. It reminds me that I have to have him back soon. But the only time that program hits the news is when somebody buys a TV or whatever, and then 900 congressmen, you know, there is 900 because they all have double lives.
It's a really interesting thing, because one of the things about the charge cards is you know a lot about all that money,
yep,
where it's going.
Yep.
And when I first got my government charge card, I tell this story. I went to the store with my daughter, and I wasn't used to my government charge card being exactly the same color as my own MasterCard. I used my government charge card to buy her a dress. I wasn't in the office 5 minutes the next day when they called and said, ma'am, you got to do something about this, because this is wrong. The controls were right there. And bless them. That's what it's for. It snagged it.
It's a MasterCard or a Visa.
And you can find these things.
Thing. Yeah.
So you have the data and you know it, and you can manage it. So yes, yeah. I'm sure there are mistakes here and there, but they can be managed. And relatively speaking, to not having a paper trail. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, you're never going to read in any of the major publications. You'll read in trade pubs, but not the major publications, the savings that go on because of programs like that.
Huge savings. Huge savings.
Know, the deployment of the LEED activity throughout the public building service. You know, massive savings. Did they write about this? Mm-hmm. No.
Money saved is not a sexy story, I guess.
No, it just... So you fall on your sword. I mean, that's a hard decision.
Oh, it was very hard. It was very hard, and I had a long weekend. I had a weekend to kind of get used to the idea before I had to share it with anybody. So that was helpful for me, because you want to maintain your composure. One of the hardest things about it was that I had to resign so abruptly. And I had been at GSA for 7 years. And the people I worked with, I knew. And we were friends. We were colleagues. We'd done a lot of good stuff together. And to disappear so suddenly and not really go through the rituals of saying goodbye was really painful, frankly. Very painful. And I still miss that. It's very hard.
Yeah, there's a lot of people there. And I know some of them got in touch relatively quickly afterwards to say,
I didn't even manage to make it home before my email was blowing up. My personal email, which meant that people had my personal email, which was interesting to me. But I was in the car when I got my first call, from somebody outside the organization completely. So, yes, if you really want to communicate, just have a piece of news put on the viral network and out it goes.
One tweet's all it takes, folks.
My network was really wonderful. There were sort of three groups to it. The first group was the I call them the banana bread brigade, and they showed up with the banana bread and the wine and the flowers and all the sympathy cards, and I have stacks of that stuff, and it was wonderful. It was really kind, really kind. And then the second group was smaller, but it was a group that was really angry, and they called me up and they would be furious about all of this, and they would scream at me and scream at the Congress and scream at the White House to me on my phone.
Right.
And I didn't really need to hear that, but frankly, it allowed me not to be so angry. I was like, okay, I can offload that job on you, because people were pretty distraught. And then there was a third group of people, smaller as well, but real. And they were Washington, sort of longstanding Washington people who said to me, wrote to me and said, y'all be fine. This is Washington. Get a grip. You're gonna be just fine. Everybody knows what this is about. This is part of the game. And it was kind of a realism thing. I wasn't ready to hear it at that point, but it's true. It's true. You can go through a lot of fire in Washington, and you know, you don't die. There's a lot that happens.
No,
you can actually grow a lot.
You have.
I have.
There
I
you
have.
Go. You're listening to Am Tower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Back with Martha and wrapping up the show after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest today is Martha Johnson. Get her book, On My Watch. You can get it in probably any physical Amazon. Bookstore, Amazon. If you want to save 75 cents, go to Books A Million. Books A Million's right. always a little cheaper.
That's true.
It is. I can get my...
But my Amazon ratings.
Oh, well, there's that. Yeah, Books A Million won't help your Amazon ratings. Right. So go to Amazon, sorry. I think Books A Million closed now. But, you know, here we are just a little while later down the road.
Mm-hmm, 2 years.
Talk mm-hmm. to me about this resilience factor.
You know, I wanted to write about that in my book because it is important to say one of the jobs of leaders is in times to fail. And then what does that look like? And how do you rebound, if you were? Although I think rebounding is a little bit harsh, makes feel like a bouncing ball. I learned something when I went through this resignation process and the sort of devastating ending of my career, that I remembered a question I used to ask my kids when they were little and they got hurt. And my question always was, are you hurt or are you surprised? And they would look at me like they could kill because they were bleeding. But the point was, I wanted them to know that surprise was available to them in the moment. And I think we need to remember that. Anytime you, any kind of major change, positive or negative, there's a little bit of a surprise in it. And the surprise is good. The surprise gives you a little bounce. It gives you a little energy. It's a little bit of whimsy. It's a good startling. And so I think that part of career resilience, you have to reclaim the surprise as well. And you do that in a couple of different ways. First of all, there are a lot of just surprises because your life changes. You know, suddenly you don't have to wear, you know, the suit. You can wear jeans all the time. Lovely little surprises like that. I was surprised I got to have lunch with my husband every day, which was a real surprise.
Yeah.
It's a real difference.
Yep.
And you treasure those. You treasure those and bank them.
You don't
them.
Have to go all the way to D.C.
I
every
don't
morning.
Have to, I don't have to go to D.C. But the second thing that can help so much is when you become the surprise. And I think there are many, many stories about this, which are a lot of fun to explore. And mine, as we talked about earlier, was to publish a novel. And when it was published, there was a little bit of press about it. People were saying, what's the gal doing after 6 months? Oh, she's published a novel. And the questions were from reporters, is it about murder on the Potomac or, you know, snakes in the Senate?
The Martha
and,
Truman.
And I said, no, it's about a gay boy in Southern Indiana. And that, the response was always dead silence. It was like, huh? And it was a surprise. I took control of the conversation. I had something new to talk about. I was a surprise. And we see it all over the place. You know, President Bush became a painter. I mean, it stops you. You say, really? Really? That's a new thing. And I think you need that in your own sort of resilience story. So that's all. That's my first round on resilience. Capture the surprise.
Okay. You touched on this. Probably a little more than touched on this, but the network support comes into play in a huge way.
You know, one of the basic rules of life is don't try to create a network when you're in crisis. You want to have your network in place, and it's really important. I don't mean a big network either. Networks big, we think big now because we think of all our, you know, the people that love us on Facebook and LinkedIn. That's not a network. A network is a group that does certain things for you, and they don't all do the same thing. Some of them give you comfort, the banana bread. Some of them confront you and say the tough stuff to you. Some of them celebrate with you when good things are happening, and some of them clarify, they explain things to you. You need a network that is performing for you, and you need to be in other people's networks. So that whole network thing, I think we need to be much smarter about, and it is a very important thing when you have a risk and downfalls.
You mean they have to be reciprocal?
They have to be reciprocal. The real question is, whose network are you in and why? What are they looking to you for? So networks are very important, and they were important to me. And that's one of the big lessons in resilience is you got to have your network in place. Can't be trolling for it then.
I have a very small inner circle. I have a fairly wide outer circle. Mm-hmm. And then I have my 6,500 LinkedIn connections.
Exactly.
But, you know, I mean, these are people who, you know, read my books, seen me speak, listen to the show, whatever.
Right.
But they're in the market. Mm-hmm. So I don't connect with people outside the government market.
Well, it's in everybody has their own map of their network, and you really do need to be intentional about that. Can't be lazy and sloppy and messy about it. Your community is important. That's an important investment.
Well, also, if I have hot gossip, I want to have 6,500 people spread it for me. Not just telling it to. I want them to spread it. So I mean, you know, you have what you call the crucible moment.
Yes, this is an actual term that I borrowed from Warren Bennis, who's out at UCLA. And it's a notion of when you go through crisis, sort of what do you learn from it? What is the great sort of awakening and new lessons? And it's very important to understand that when you go through crises, you really do grow. Post-traumatic growth is the way to think about it. And that's actually the next book I'm writing. And I had a couple that were pretty obvious. The first one, probably the most important one in many ways, was that I had gone through this crisis and I'd been all over the media, been on Jon Stewart, all that stuff. And so I now, when I get together with friends my age, they're all, they're still twisting their hands and wringing them about whether or not they're losing their privacy on Facebook and why should they tweet and all that sort of thing. It's like they're really skeptical about social media. Me, I'm not the least bit skeptical about social media because I'm already out there. And the crisis gave that to me. I didn't have to kind of overcome my anxieties and concerns that are typical to my age group about, you know, this new form, because the new form was in my life already. Mm-hmm. And therefore I was able to
permeated
step right
GSA
into it.
Too.
So. It went right there. So yeah. There were those kinds of just very functional things that happened as a result of that crisis for me. And I enjoy being on social media now. I'm doing a lot of, you know, the blogging and the tweeting and, mm-hmm. And the Facebook and so on. That's all really good. And it's a community. And I'm struck by how it extends me into the younger community, people my children's age, and also connects me to older friends, very, very older friends who can't get out and can't move around, and I can stay in touch with them so much easier. So social media has a place in my life much more quickly and abruptly because of that whole crisis.
Okay. I have one final question.
Sure.
And you can take 2 whole minutes with it. So after all of this, you've seen the very positive side of public service and the, you know, you're the one that's going to be shot at dawn side of public service. Would you recommend public service to the next generation?
I would, as I would go back into public service if I were to ever have that option. It is, I think, an extraordinary experience, and there are a couple of reasons that I say that, and I'm not being sort of sloppy about it. I think public service is a place to do very interesting work and to have very interesting colleagues. The average education level in the government is higher than anywhere else, and people are educated and they're thoughtful, and you have that kind of collegial base. But truth be told, work is hard. Work is hard in the government, and work is hard outside the government. People who are, researching the cause of AIDS, and people who are teaching teenagers, and people who are guarding prisoners, and people who are farming in the Midwest, work is not easy. And so the whole notion that public service is somehow tough is not quite right. Everything is tough. If it's real work, if it's making a difference, it's going to be hard. It's going to be challenging, and there are going to be obstacles. Yes, there's a bureaucracy, and there are particular curiosities in public service, but I think it is an enormously valuable contribution to make. The other thing I will say, and this is from having been in the private sector and the public sector both, is that when you're in the public sector, you're part of a community. And that community means something. You can, when you see other people who are in public service, when you meet them, you have a bond with them. I never saw that in business. I never had that experience when I was in the corporation. I didn't have that sort of automatic community that I belonged to, that we'd all taken the oath and we all had some reason to sort of nod to each other and say, you too, me too, we're here together. And that is hugely valuable for a person in their career and in their life, to belong to that kind of an endeavor and to have that kind of sense of collegiality and community. I would absolutely recommend it.
Cool. Martha Johnson, the book is On My Watch. Get it. Read it. take a look at her blog, too. How do people find your blog?
Oh, thank you. www.marthajohnson.com.
That's a toughie.
It's pretty great.
It was available, too, huh?
Well, my husband got it like 20 years ago. Bless him. So, yes, it's MarthaJohnson.com. Yep, really.
Smart.
Yes, he is.
make him a nice lunch one day.
Well, someday.
So, there you go. Martha, thank you so much for coming in. This has been a blast. We are going to do it again. We didn't get to my John Shinseki question, but maybe we'll do that soon.
Oh, that's true. We
soon.
Can talk about that again.
There you go. Mm-hmm. All right. You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. This is not my day job. If your company is not fully leveraging LinkedIn, we need to talk. Find me on LinkedIn or drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net. And thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off-Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off-Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.